Welcome to today's deep dive. We're really glad you're joining us. So I want to start with a question for you. Have you ever skipped a couple of seasons of a TV show?
Oh, guilty. Yeah, absolutely.
Right. And when you finally tune back in, suddenly all the characters are wearing completely different clothes.
They're speaking a totally different language.
Yes. And they're fighting entirely different enemies. You're just sitting there on your couch thinking, wait, what did I miss? Did I skip a whole series?
It's just a completely profound sense of disorientation.
Exactly. And honestly, that is exactly the experience most people have when they turn the page from the end of the Old Testament to the beginning of the New Testament.
Yeah, it really is. Because you're moving from a world that is primarily, Hebrew speaking.
Ruled by these massive Eastern empires.
Right, like the Babylonians or the Persians.
Yeah.
And you step right into a world where suddenly everyone is speaking Greek. They're arguing with Roman centurions.
Yeah, and debating entirely different theological concepts.
It's a massive, jarring cultural shock.
It really is. The setting is completely different. The cast of characters is just swapped out. But it isn't just the politics or the language that changes. It's the core
But
ideas.
theology itself shifts.
Exactly. And today, we're unpacking this based on Dr. Anthony J. Tomasino's lecture series, Judaism Before Jesus. We really want to bridge this massive gap because there is this ultimate mystery sitting right there in the
And
transition.
it's an incredible mystery when you step back and look at it.
Right, take this massive theological theme like the resurrection of the dead.
Oh, yes. That's a perfect example.
If you read through the Old Testament, that concept is, well, it's virtually
It
absent.
just isn't a primary concern for those writers at all.
But then you flip that single thin piece of paper to the New Testament, and suddenly it is the absolute central obsession of the entire text. Everybody is talking about it.
It literally becomes the driving force of the New Testament narrative.
Yeah. So how do we get there?
Well, to understand how we got from point A to point B, to understand why the world of the New Testament looks the way it does, we have to look at what happened during those intervening 400 years.
History often lazily calls this the 400 silent years, right?
Lazily is the right word, because that era was anything but silent. It was a crucible, it was loud, it was violent, and it was transformative.
But to truly grasp the weight of the changes that happened during that supposedly silent period, we first have to understand what these people actually lost.
Exactly. You can't understand the ruins if you don't know what the building looked like in the first place.
Right. Now, we all know the foundational beats of the Old Testament. You've got Abraham, the Exodus out of Egypt.
Joshua pushing into the promised land.
Yeah, the era of those charismatic judges. And eventually, you get that golden age under King David and King Solomon.
Where Solomon builds this breathtaking, monumental first temple in Jerusalem.
Right. But I mean, trying to pin exact dates on those early events gets incredibly messy, doesn't it?
Oh, extremely messy. There is a long tradition going back to people like the 17th century scholar Bishop Usher.
Oh, the guy who tried to just add everything up?
Yes, exactly. He tried to reconstruct perfect historical timelines by simply adding up the lifespans and the numbers in ancient biblical genealogies.
Didn't he calculate that creation happened on like a very specific day?
He did. Usher famously calculated that creation happened in exactly 4004 BC.
Wow.
But as we understand now, trying to rigidly define a fluid ancient timeline with modern math, it just doesn't work.
Because they weren't writing modern history books.
Right. Those ancient genealogies weren't modern census reports. They were highly selective. They skipped generations to make specific theological points.
So trying to date the Exodus or the Judges down to the specific year is a bit of a fool's errand.
Yeah, the lecture series actually makes a great joke about this. It's a fool's rush in where angels fear to tread situation.
I love that. But we do know that the Golden Age under Solomon eventually fractures, the kingdom splits in two.
Right. You end up with 10 tribes in the north, known as Israel.
With their capital in Samaria.
And then you have the southern kingdom, Judah,
Yeah.
centered in Jerusalem. And that division, that fracture, is what sets the stage for the first great collapse.
Okay, let's talk about that collapse. Because the northern kingdom gets systematically dismantled by the Assyrian Empire, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
And the Assyrians didn't just conquer, they had a very specific, brutal mechanism of control.
They deported people, didn't they?
They did. They deported the native population and imported foreigners to settle the land. It effectively scrambled the demographics of the entire region.
Just completely erase their cohesive identity.
Yes. And this is the origin of the famous 10 Lost Tribes. And importantly, it's also the origin story of the Samaritans.
Ah, the Samaritans.
Yeah, a mixed heritage group that becomes highly significant and frankly highly despised by purists later in the narrative.
I want to pause on the Assyrians for a second, because the source material uses this vivid Star Trek analogy that just perfectly captures this ancient geopolitical dynamic.
It's a surprisingly great analogy.
It really is. So you look at the Assyrians and the Israelites, and they were essentially like the Romulans and the Vulcans.
Yes, remarkably apt.
Right, because they shared the same ancient DNA. They were both Semitic peoples.
Their languages were incredibly similar.
They probably even looked alike. But ideologically, they were violently opposed. The Assyrians were ruthlessly efficient, militaristic expansionists.
So it was a brutal, devastating conquest. But it was a conquest by a neighbor you inherently understood. You recognized them.
Yeah, like an evil twin. But Judah, the southern kingdom, they managed to dodge that Assyrian bullet for a while.
They do. However, their luck runs out due to internal corruption. The narrative highlights the extreme apostasy of leaders like King Manasseh,
who was reportedly sacrificing children to the god Baal. Just incredibly dark stuff.
Exactly. So eventually the hammer falls on the south, too.
Yeah.
But this time it isn't the Assyrians. It's the Babylonians.
In 587 BC, right?
Yes. 587 BC. Babylon conquers the south, knocks down the walls of Jerusalem, and completely destroys Solomon's temple.
And they deport the king and the leading citizens, the elite, the artisans, the priests, all hauled off all the way over to Babylon.
This is the great trauma of the exile.
Because you've lost your land, you've lost your king, and you've lost the temple. And the temple wasn't just like a big church down the street. It was the literal center of your universe.
It was the anchor of their entire identity.
Right.
And what's fascinating here is how that absolute displacement actually forged a new identity. Think about how the prophet Jeremiah looked at this catastrophe.
Okay.
He categorized the people during this Babylonian exile into two distinct groups. He called them the good figs and the bad figs.
Wait, hold on. Calling the people who were left behind to starve in the rubble bad feels incredibly harsh. I mean, weren't they the victims here?
Oh, absolutely.
It sounds like a massive PR spin by the elites who got taken away.
That is exactly what it is. It's entirely a framing mechanism by the people who wrote the history.
Typical.
Right. The good figs were the upper-class exiles who were taken to Babylon. In that foreign environment, surrounded by strange gods and strange customs, they realized they were on the verge of just disappearing.
Of just blending in and fading away.
Exactly. So they closed ranks, they solidified their traditions, they started writing down their oral laws, they formalized their identity, they became incredibly rigid and defined.
So they basically had to decide, like, are we going to become Babylonian or are we going to be more Jewish than ever before?
Precisely. And they chose the latter. The bad figs, on the other hand, well, they were the peasant class left behind in the ruined land of Judah.
The ones struggling to just survive.
Right. And without the temple, without the priesthood to guide them, they eventually just assimilated with the neighboring Canaanites and Edomites. They lost their distinct identity.
Wow.
Like a powerful reminder for you listening right now. The human identity is so often forged and weaponized during a crisis.
That's such a great point.
The exiles in Babylon knew exactly who they were, precisely because they were no longer at home.
And that brings up a really logical pivot point, because eventually the Babylonian Empire falls.
Everything falls eventually.
Right. In 538 BC, Cyrus the Great of Persia conquers Babylon. And Cyrus is, well, he's fascinating.
He is often called the first true individual in history.
Because of his unique ruling philosophy, right? He actually tells the captive peoples, you know what? You can go home, go back and rebuild.
Yes.
But, and this is the crazy part, if Babylon is this ancient Manhattan full of culture, beautiful architecture, great wine, and wealth, and Jerusalem is literally a burned out pile of rocks, why on earth would anyone actually leave?
No, the truth is most of them didn't.
I wouldn't have.
Right. Going home was highly complicated. A massive, thriving Jewish community chose to stay in Babylon simply because life was better there.
Sure.
But a remnant, driven by that newly hardened identity we just talked about,
yeah,
they do return. And their primary overriding goal is to rebuild that central pillar of their faith, the temple.
So they get back, they clear the rubble, and they finally complete the second temple in 515 BC. But the reaction of the people is just heartbreaking.
It really is.
Instead of throwing a massive party, the older generation, the ones who were children before the exile, who could actually remember the sheer scale of Solomon's original temple, they just weep.
They look at this new building and they cry because it is just a pale, underwhelming shadow of their former glory.
I mean, imagine that. You work for decades to rebuild your home, and when it's finally done, it just serves as a physical monument to everything you've permanently lost.
It embeds this deep-seated national disappointment right into the foundation of their new era.
Yeah. So dealing with that fragility, dealing with a community that feels incredibly vulnerable, you see the rise of figures like Ezra and Nehemiah.
Right. Ezra acts as the spiritual leader.
Mm-hmm.
He's the one standardizing the law of Moses, enforcing strict boundaries on who people can marry, how they should behave.
And Nehemiah is tasked with a very physical boundary. He's rebuilding the stone wall around the city of Jerusalem.
Mm.
But here's where it gets really interesting. Why is a wall so incredibly important? In the modern day, we just think of a wall as, you know, a defense mechanism to keep arrows out. But there's a much deeper psychological layer here, isn't there?
Oh, absolutely. In later Jewish tradition, particularly in the collection of oral laws known as the Mishnah, a wall is given a very specific legal and spiritual definition.
Okay, what is it?
A wall is literally what separates a mere gathering of people from a true city. Without a wall, you are just a vulnerable group of individuals camping out.
Ah, I see.
The wall legally and spiritually defines you as a unified entity.
So stacking those stones was the physical manifestation of a psychological reality. They were attempting to reconstruct their spiritual and cultural boundaries because they felt so totally exposed.
They had to draw a hard line between themselves and the outside world.
Mm-hmm.
Because the outside world was about to get much, much stranger.
Yeah, because even though they were back in their walled city, they were not independent.
Not at all. They were just subjects paying tribute to a revolving door of foreign superpowers.
And if you look at the sequence of those empires, a fascinating pattern emerges. The march of empires goes geographically and ideologically further and further away from their comfort zone.
Yes, the alienation escalates.
We started with Assyria and Babylon, and as we mentioned with the Star Trek analogy, they were Semitic, they spoke Aramaic, they were geographically relatively close.
Right. They were cruel, yes, but they were comprehensible.
But then you move to the Persians.
And the Persians are Indo-Aryan. It's a completely different language family, and their capital is geographically much further away.
And then come the Greeks and eventually the Romans. Let me put it this way, to make this cultural whiplash relatable for you listening. Imagine your hometown is taken over by a neighboring city.
Annoying, but manageable.
Right. It's intensely annoying. You have to pay them taxes, but you still understand the local jokes. You eat the same food. But then your town is taken over by a state entirely across the country.
A bit weirder.
And then a few generations later, you are conquered by a country across the ocean who doesn't even speak English. The cultural whiplash must have been staggering.
Staggering is the perfect word.
The people telling you how to live in Jerusalem didn't even share basic assumptions about reality anymore.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, this escalating alienation is the exact pressure cooker that forces the transformation of the Jewish faith.
How so?
Well, the further away their ruler's culture gets from their own, the more foreign the surrounding ideology becomes. So the more defensive and rigidly defined their own theology has to become to survive.
You have to draw a sharper line in the sand when the culture across that line is completely alien to you.
Exactly.
And that pressure cooker finally explodes when we get to the Greeks.
Alexander the Great.
Alexander sweeps through the Middle East, conquering the vast Persian Empire in a blink of an eye. But Alexander dies young.
Very young. And his massive empire splinters into pieces. His generals basically carve up the map among themselves.
And poor Judea gets caught right in the middle of a brutal, centuries-long tug of war between two of these successor states. You have the Seleucid Empire and the Ptolemaic Empire.
To briefly clarify those factions for the listener, the Ptolemaic Empire was based down in Egypt.
Right.
And the Seleucid Empire was based up in Syria. Judea was the unfortunate land bridge between them.
The doormat, basically.
Yes. And it is under the Seleucids, specifically a king named Antiochus Epiphanes, that the cultural pressure turns into an existential threat.
Because Antiochus Epiphanes wasn't just interested in collecting taxes. He looked at his territory and decided that this stubborn, unique Jewish religion was the root cause of all his political instability.
He viewed them as a problem to be solved.
So he decides to violently stamp it out. And we aren't just talking about, you know, closing a few synagogues. How did this Hellenization, this forced adoption of Greek culture, actually work on the ground?
The aggressive, multi-front assault on their identity. Hellenization wasn't just about speaking Greek. It was about adopting Greek philosophy, Greek dress, and Greek civic institutions.
Right. For instance, the Greeks built a gymnasium right in Jerusalem.
Now, to modern ears, A gym sounds pretty harmless.
Right. But in the ancient world, the gymnasium was the center of Greek education and socialization. And crucially, it was done entirely naked.
Which was an absolute scandal to traditional Jewish sensibilities.
Completely abhorrent. Furthermore, Antiochus outlawed core religious practices. He banned circumcision. He banned observing the Sabbath.
And the worst part, he ordered the sacrifice of pigs.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
A deeply unclean animal sacrificed right on the altar of the Jewish temple.
He was trying to surgically remove their identity.
He was.
He unleashes these bloody, violent purges. And that pushes the people past the breaking point. It triggers a massive rebellion in 167 BC.
This is the famous Maccabean Revolt, or more historically accurately, the Hasmonean Revolt, named after the family that led it.
And against all odds, fighting a guerrilla war against a massive imperial army, they win. By 140 BC, they actually achieve their independence. It's astonishing. For the first time since Babylon showed up at their gates in 605 BC, they are completely free from a foreign yoke.
It's an incredible moment of triumph.
At their height, the Hasmonean kingdom actually expanded its borders to roughly the size of King David's legendary empire. They had finally achieved what they had been longing, praying, and bleeding for over centuries. A sovereign Jewish state.
You know, it's funny. Pop culture like that movie, 300, loves to paint these ancient conflicts in stark black and white.
Oh, definitely.
You have the noble, rational, freedom-loving Greeks fighting the crazed, barbaric Easterners. But when you look at the reality for the people actually caught in the middle of these empires, there were no clear good guys or bad guys.
Not at all.
It was just a relentless meat grinder of regime changes. One superpower crushes another, and you just have to figure out how to survive the new management, who usually turn out to be just as brutal as the last.
Which makes the ultimate tragedy of the Hasmonean dynasty so bitterly ironic.
Because they didn't keep that independence very long.
No. And they didn't lose their hard-won independence to another invading army, overwhelming them on the battlefield. They lost it entirely from within.
Internal squabbling, right?
Severe internal squabbling. Corruption, and eventually devastating civil war between two royal brothers. It weakened the nation so much that they actually invited foreign intervention to settle their dispute.
They practically opened the door for Rome.
Exactly. The highly practical, highly organized Romans, led by the general Pompey, arrived in the east in 63 BC.
And the Romans looked at the chaos in Judea, decided the territory was strategically vital for their eastern frontier, and simply took over.
After centuries of waiting and fighting for their freedom, the Jewish people held it in their hands for a fleeting moment, watched their own leaders corrupt it, and then lost it entirely to Rome.
This profound, crushing disappointment is crucial because it sets the perfect psychological and theological stage for the New Testament's desperate longing for a savior.
The earthly kingdoms had failed them.
Even their own earthly kings had failed them. So the hope had to shift to something beyond the earthly realm.
Which brings us right to the edge of the New Testament. Because the Romans don't just rule directly at first. They set up client kings to do their dirty work.
And that gives us one of the most infamous, complex figures in history. Herod the Great.
Yes.
Herod is fascinating because he's deeply, deeply insecure. He's not fully Jewish. He's Idumean. So the people hate him, and he knows it.
He is painfully aware of it.
So he looks at that disappointing second temple, the one the old generation wept over centuries ago, and he essentially decides to overcompensate.
He says, we can do better.
Right. He literally dismantles it, hauls the stones out, and builds a magnificent, glittering new temple in its place.
It was one of the architectural wonders of the ancient world. The largest temple complex ever constructed.
It is a stunning achievement, but it's built by a paranoid tyrant.
Exactly. Herod was constantly terrified of losing his throne. He murdered his own wives and his own sons to protect his power.
And this paranoia perfectly ties this entire historical epic together, creating a brilliant narrative parallel between the very beginning of the Old Testament story and the dawn of the New Testament.
The slaughter of the innocents.
Precisely. At the very start of the biblical narrative in Egypt, you have the Pharaoh.
Right. He is terrified of a growing Hebrew population that might rise up and deliver themselves. So he orders Hebrew babies to be thrown into the Nile River to drown.
And centuries later, after all the empires have risen and fallen, you have Herod the Great. He is terrified of rumors of a newly born prophesied king, so he orders the slaughter of the babies in Bethlehem.
Both tyrants, separated by thousands of years, resorting to the exact same atrocity because they are terrified of a deliverer they cannot control.
It's chilling. So what does this all mean for you listening to this right now?
It's the key to the whole era.
It means that to truly understand the mindset of the New Testament, to understand why everyday people, you know, fishermen and tax collectors, were so desperately longing for a Messiah, why they were so captivated by the idea of an ultimate divine rescue, you cannot skip the middle of the story.
You have to understand the deep trauma, the brief corrupt triumphs, and the crushing disappointments of those 400 supposedly silent years.
You have to see the scars of the battles that happened off screen. Only then do you understand exactly why they are fighting so hard and what they are truly afraid of losing.
And this raises an important question, one that I think is the most profound takeaway from this entire exploration.
What's that?
Well, we noted at the very beginning that the concept of the resurrection of the dead was almost entirely absent in the Old Testament, but suddenly became the central driving obsession of the New Testament.
Right.
Given everything we have just discussed, the relentless cycle of foreign empires, the aggressive attempts at cultural and physical erasure by kings like Antiochus, the heartbreaking loss of their fleeting independence, you have to ask, how much of that fierce, unyielding belief in an afterlife, in a bodily resurrection, was born directly as a psychological survival mechanism?
Oh, wow.
If the earthly world guarantees nothing but political trauma, endless conquest, and the destruction of everything you build, perhaps the only way to cope, the only way to maintain your faith in a just God, is to move the promise of restoration beyond the reach of Roman swords.
To a resurrection that no empire can ever conquer.
Exactly. That is the world they were living in.
That is just so much to think about. A perfect thought to leave you with today. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive, and we'll catch you next time.